Hi everyone, I'm Gary Nall. Today we're going to learn a lot about how our government does not work for us. Very specific, very detailed information, not speculative. And then I'm going to open up the phones so you can call in and share your points of view. And from what I understand, we have a few people called in yesterday and have shared their views, and we'll hear from them in a moment. We're going to start by learning a study from Boston University, published in the British Medical Journal of Nutrition, says that drinking fruit juice early in life has long-term dietary benefits. Now, we're talking about 100% fruit juice. We're not talking about, you know, fruited flavored water with sugar. So that's a good thing to know, and we'll know more. Now, just so you know which number to call in, our talkback number is 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. And wait till after my commentaries. Also, I'm going to be doing something every week, and that is sharing positive and inspirational ways of dealing with our crisis, whatever the crisis may be. And we're all faced with multiple crises right now. Will we get COVID? Have we got COVID? Do we have antibodies? Are the antibodies protective? Does the test work? Does it give you false readings like false positives and false negatives? The answer to that is yes. Yes, we do not have a standardized test. Yes, we do have false positives and false negatives. So there's a lot of confusion. But what we are finding out is we've been misinformed. Whether intentionally or not, I will not say. But I can tell you that almost all the information we've been given has been incomplete or incorrect. And in the process, it has destroyed tens of millions of people's lives. So yeah, a lot of people are very concerned. And even healthcare professionals, we're talking about doctors, are also concerned because, quote, from Fair Health, healthcare professional revenue falls by 50% across the nation during the COVID-19 pandemic. Oral surgery and gastroenterology declined the most of specialty studies per Fair Health's third COVID-X report, which means that doctors have lost a tremendous amount of money. Now, why should you be concerned? I'll explain that in a little commentary in a few moments. So our program today is going to take an honest, with no sugarcoating, look at the institutions that we have empowered who now have absolute, total, abject power over us. And with that said, I'll be sharing some insights from John Whitehead, The Slippery Slope to Despotism, Paved with Lockdowns, Raids, and Forced Vaccinations. And that's why today as we speak, there are people protesting, and good for them. I fully support your protests when it comes to letting the New York Bar Association, who wants to see every single person in New York State, every man, woman, and child, no matter what your age or physical condition, you would have to get this. You would be no exemptions. That's fascism. Well, they're lawyers. Why should we be surprised? Talk about a self-serving group. These are all great white sharks looking for nosebleeds. And they're going to recommend to the utterly corrupt New York State legislature, mandate it. And behind all this is the American Legislative Exchange Council, a consortium of nearly 200 to 300 companies, all major companies, and who make money when they get to write the rules. And then the state passes them as if they were somehow in the best interest of the citizens of that state. That's never the case. So in any case, we're going to talk about that. Also, I'm looking at what happens around the United States. Remember this, please. For every action in the universe, there is an equal reaction. And unfortunately, you can't control when and what degree that reaction will be. Say something nice to someone, say something kind, say something that allows them to feel good about that moment and the connection that you have with them, and you get a reaction. But it's a good reaction. It's a complimentary reaction. Now say something snarly, sarcastic, something where you've weaponized your language, your eye contact, your body language, your words to make the person feel defensive, to make them feel disempowered, and you get a reaction. But sometimes that reaction is not in the moment and not what you think. So right now, as a society, we're engaged in a lot of actions without any awareness that there's going to be reactions. More on that when I discuss Professor Henry Giroux's counterpunch piece on the criminogenic politics as a form of psychosis in the age of Trump. So we have a lot to share. Well, we always begin with the latest on health and healing. And today, a new study from Boston University shows that drinking 100% fruit juice early in life was associated with healthier dietary patterns in later childhood without adversely impacting weight gain. The study found that the consumption of the fruit juices during the preschool years was associated with higher intakes of whole fruit and total fruit, as well as better diets, and therefore less, going into middle age, less diabetes, less illness. It just makes sense. If you grew up and you have apples and you drink apple juice or apple cider, if you have oranges and you drink fresh orange juice, and it's wonderful when you drive around Florida, especially southern Florida, where I'm at, you see just thousands of people who have one or more orange trees in their front yard. And yeah, they go out and they'll pick them. And in other places, they'll have little vineyards. In France, if you've ever been to France, and I hope you can get to France, it's a wonderful country, tremendous heritage, and some really sharp minds. People there are really acute on being aware of the life they're living. So you can have conversations in Italy and France completely different on the same topic. But it's absolutely common to see just a regular school teacher, regular person with a beautiful wine collection in their basement. One guy, he had 27,000 bottles of wine. And he was a school teacher. And he was a friend of one of my friends that lived nearby. And he did it all. And he went through the whole process of how you make wine and yourself. Now, that's good, because then you're more likely to eat grapes. And what did I find on the tables of so many people? Either grapes, that was the most common thing, but also I found apples and in-season pears. In fact, when we were staying in a nunnery, a bunch of us who went over, a couple of my friends, Franco Pantoni, who's from Italy, and his parents still live there, and we were given a wonderful meal, very, very accommodating, very nice. The nuns were extremely nice. We had nice conversations because there was nothing else to do. I mean, no televisions, nothing. Just they would go and pray. We would have conversations. But they kept bringing out fruit. I mean, for like hours, they'd bring, of course, my buddies, my brothers. They just nonstop eating. And so it would be pears, apples, grapes, plums, so all kinds of fruit. And that's common over there. It's not common in the United States. We're not used to drinking fresh juices. We're used to drinking a pasteurized juice. And young people are used to drinking fruit drinks, which are no fruit in them, lots of sugar. And then that develops a certain taste, an acquired taste. So therefore, when they eat a strawberry, it's not sweet enough. They eat an orange, it's too bitter. They're used to that sugar, and that makes an enormous difference in the taste preferences of children. So that's why, for those parents who are listening now, and I know there's a lot of you, you've taught your children to accept the natural flavor of food. Now, just think of it this way. Imagine that you were not allowed to put anything on a hot dog or a hamburger. Nothing. You had to eat it, just the hot dog and hamburger. And you couldn't put anything on a steak. Would we have the same amount of consumption? I believe not, because it's the accommodating condiments that we put on that frequently then impart the smell, the taste, the mouthfeel, and the aftertaste that we develop. And So would you eat a pizza that had no cheese? Now, what would happen if you ate a pizza that had non-dairy cheese? And what if you ate a crust that was not overcooked and was actually baked at 120 degrees, so it still had no carcinogenicity, it hadn't become acrylamided, and it was made from millet flour instead of whole wheat flour with its gluten? Would you still eat it? Well, a lot of people are growing up having a pizza, but it's a healthy pizza, and having different foods, but they're healthy, and juices are the healthy things you can put in your body. They tested out in the Life Energy experiment I did at the Institute of Applied Biology in cooperation with Dr. Douglas Dean and a couple of people from Drexel University. One of them saw me on television in a national debate, and we had that debate, by the way. You can go to prn.fm and scroll down, and it was my study over a two-year period where I showed that an energy was transferred from a group of individuals into mice. Now, they couldn't hold the mice, but they could pray or meditate, whatever they were doing to share their energy. Rabbi Abraham Wiseman from Brooklyn, Dr. Thomas Kruth from the Order of St. Luke, Dr. Morton Jacobs. He was known as the chiropractor with the healing hands. And there was Dr. Audrey Carger, who was using light therapy. And there was also Catherine Coleman, Olga Worrell. These were televangelist healers. I'd never met them until the study. And one didn't come in person. One did, Olga Worrell did, but the other did distance healing. The great Harry Edwards from Great Britain, he was a phenomena. One day when I have time, I'll tell you about the trip where I wanted to confirm if something could work. If something can work in an animal, it should be able to work in a human when it comes to energy, because the universe does not create half-truths. So the idea was, if there's an energy force that can influence one sentient life, why can't it influence all sentient life? So I took a fellow to Great Britain, and he was not a nice person. He had a really distempered personality. He was very sarcastic and moody, and his sister, who was the one who asked, could I take him? She was a nurse, practitioner, and he had hurt his back in a diving accident when he was a teenager. Now he's in his 40s, and he's always, you know, complaining he can't bend over. He's got to wear this back brace for his entire life. He can't exercise. So he would have been the perfect candidate because we had a medically irreversible condition. That's important. And then we had to take him to five separate diagnosticians, board-certified people who took x-rays and did the analysis. So when we came back, if there was any change, we would have proof that he wasn't healed from something he did not have, because everyone in this audience who works in the healing profession knows that that's the common, well, they never had the cancer, so you didn't cure them of cancer. They never had AIDS, you never cured them. They never had heart disease, never, you know, yeah, that's why I just showed you the, and by the way, I want to thank the thousands of people who've gone up and watched the six-minute Fred Fisher tape. You talk about something completely documented, his own physician we interviewed, and then every step of his one-year journey where he lost 350 pounds, reversed kidney failure, reversed liver failure, reversed congestive heart failure, reversed a blood, you talk about diabetes. His blood sugar was 500. His cholesterol was over 500, numbers you can't imagine. But when you're 750 pounds and you've been in a couch for 6 months and you're just pure fat and skin and manic depression, and yet 1 year later, everything reversed, not a single disease. And the doctor said this. We have all the medical records. Anyhow, he came to Detroit, and what he brought his belt. Now, I'm 6'2", so when he held the belt up, it was taller than me. And then he showed his current belt, and it was just like it was normal size, because he still weighed, you know, around 300 plus pounds, but it sure wasn't what it was. And he would sit on a stoop over in Brooklyn and just give common sense advice. And I asked, how many people have you, oh, over the years, probably a couple thousand. So that's good. Who knows who he passed that forward, and whose lives were improved because of Fred Fisher. A gentle, giant. He was a big guy, but he was a gentle human being. Well, imagine you're a holistic dentist like Almira Gadol, one of the best in the world, and you're using ozone and these microneedles to get up into that oral cavity. So you're really killing off the actual bacteria that is part of the problems when we have root canal, not getting the bacteria, so then the bacteria regrow later, and then the infection continues. Well, no, get it out, it's dead. Imagine you're one of the doctors giving all night long, and I mean all night long, giving special therapies to a very famous person, I mean a very world-famous person, at the Tri-State Healing Center when that person's assistant came in, person was dying. Now imagine you're one of that whole medical team and nursing team, and I was there all night. We were all there all night, and we broke his infection, and he lived. What do you think anyone's going to say? Well, he never really was that sick, so you didn't save his life. And yet we've saved millions upon millions of lives, or improved the quality of them, from chiropractors to homeopaths, from holistic nurses to dentists, from massage therapists to herbalists to wellness coaches, to humanistic psychologists, the tapping therapies, the Qigong. All these modalities work, all based upon energy. So anyhow, getting back to the main point. So, and I'll tell you the whole Harry Edwards story, what happened when we took Michael to England. Oh, it was a hoot. And thank goodness I went out in the hallway at 11 o'clock at night, because there's the fellow walking with his suitcase. And I said, where are you going? He said, I'm going to the airport. This is all crazy. You're all nuts. None of this has helped me. I've seen all these people. And I said, we only have one more to see tomorrow. Then we'll all go home together. And then if it doesn't work, okay, we tried. But just one more. He said, okay, but I'm not happy about this. I said, and I wish that any of the ones we've seen up to this point, Dr. Ian Wally Hart and Dr. Chris, these are mainstream physicians. But in Great Britain, they believe in energy healing. And so that's the way it went. And the next day, wow, thank goodness I hired a BBC independent cinematographer to come and film it. It's going to take me a half hour to tell you that story, so I'll save that. But it's all about energy healing. So anyhow, it worked, and also the head of nursing at New York University School of Nursing was there also, and it worked. And so they saw the television program where I was debating one of America's leading atheists, where he was saying there is no such thing as, you know, the energy and spirituality and all this is all nonsense. You know, when you're alive and you're dead and nothing else is going to impact you. Your prayers don't matter, your beliefs don't matter, etc. But he was wrong. I had the evidence. And he could not watch the debate, watch the whole debate. I found this old tape. And it's from around 1972. And you see it. And you see how closed-minded he was. But the reality is that energy is exchanged. So if energy is exchanged, and then in comes these real great minds from Drexel who want to do an experiment. And I said, fine. And we found that juices had the highest energy, fresh-made juices. They were a 10 on a scale of 10, meaning the ultimate energy you can put into your body to heal are juices, fresh organic juices. And right behind that are your concentrates. And then behind that are your fresh fruits. So, anyhow, more on that. So that this whole Boston University study, the drinking fruit juice early in life can have long-term dietary benefits. Yeah, but so can you at this time. If you did not have that kind of upbringing, you can start today with fresh juices. Start with one a day for the first week, two a day for the second week, three a day for the third week, and stay there for 6 months. At the end of 6 months, then four a day, then five a day, and six a day. And that then when you want to go through the big cleanse, the big clean, then it goes up from there. But there's special juices for special things. I'm just giving you an overview that the more you juice fresh, healthy juices, the longer you're going to live, the less strokes, heart attacks, and cancer and diabetes you're going to have. From Washington State University comes a study about cannabis. It helps relieve post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms, at least temporarily. This is published in the Journal of Affective Disorders. So what it's saying is simple. People suffering from post-traumatic distress disorder report that cannabis reduces the severity of their symptoms by more than half, at least in the short term. Well, that's terrific. And so when we consider how many millions of people are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, and that means they have returning thoughts of traumatic events, they have flashbacks, they have irritability, they have anxiety, and all of those were reduced substantially with cannabis. So that's a good study. And by the way, if all goes well, by the early fall, I'll be officially opening the first in the world, the first holistic, humanistic center to help veterans, our brave men and women, to overcome their stress and their homelessness and all the crisis, and also Gulf War syndrome, whatever chemical imbalances exist in their body, their brain, the central nervous system, their muscular system, their hormonal system. We're going to address all of that with holistic medical protocols. So it's all ready to go. The structure is ready. Staff is ready. So when I say I'm going to do something, I'll do it. And this is about to happen. So more on that once we select the first 20 people, and then we're going to be filming every stage of it. And my goal is within 6 months to have a group of people who are completely healthy, normal, happy, and able to reenter their families and society and work again. And then make that into a documentary, stream it over the internet, and then have other people around the world use that as a model and hopefully open up hundreds, or if they could open up thousands of these all over to help all these human beings whose society has forgotten. Finally, from Harpopio University in Greece, published in the Journal of Medicinal Food, the Mediterranean diet is found to ameliorate symptoms of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, which is a killer. That's terrific. So again, we're talking about a healthy diet, lots of fruits and vegetables, lots of nuts and seeds, lots of beans, some fish, okay, and stay away from the meats and the dairy. We are 23 minutes into our program. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, let's go to your calls. And by the way, if you would like to call in and leave a message, maybe you don't feel comfortable talking live. Okay, just leave a message on our voicemail. Please write down this number, 862-800-6805, 862-800-6805. And on any of the themes, you have an opinion you'd like to share, and we'll play it. And then if I have any feedback, I'll be happy to share my feedback on it. And a lot of people are listening live. You can listen live Monday to Friday at noon to 1 by calling this number, 774-337-6068, 774-337-6068. Back in a moment with our voicemail calls.
Hello, Gary. I'd like to answer your question. I think there's two things with the students. First, they should be obliged to read what the material that is going to be taught before they get into class. The problem is they've been fed propaganda and a fantasy land of the United States. And so when they get into the courses, it's a cultural shock of what the truth is. The other part is that there are many professors that don't know how to teach. Maybe they're intelligent, but they just don't have the right stuff to stimulate people's minds. But students are paying for that. So in other words, it's up to the professors to do what they teach the way the students want to learn. Maybe that's why in England they have tutors. Maybe that's what they need. The second point is the police. The police should be held responsible financially. If they can afford, and I was absolutely shocked that the police are buying off the political process. If they can afford to buy off the political process, then they should be responsible financially for the harm that they do. Why should the community pay for it? It's not the community that shot the people. It is the police that allowed another policeman to kill somebody, to execute somebody. It's becoming the United States of assassinations and executions. Tragic. But the work you're doing on the radio is making a difference. Unfortunately, it doesn't show in the statistics because there are 1,000 people being shot year after year in the United States. But it's making a difference. This protests are making a difference, hopefully. Thank you. My name is Rudy. Goodbye.
Okay, Rudy, thank you for your call. I'd like to share some insights into what you were just discussing. I agree with you, and I think it's just prudent that a person should be financially responsible for the mistakes they make if those mistakes were preventable, if those mistakes were impulsive, if those mistakes were due to a person's lack of good judgment. If, however, a person is making a mistake that is an institutional mistake based upon their training, then I do not believe the person should be held financially, personally responsible because it's not directly and fully the person's responsibility. It would be no different than if we're all taught as medical doctors, if everyone went to medical school and we were all taught the same way to engage in a certain procedure to prescribe a drug, and if we made mistakes, we have liability insurance to protect so the person isn't sued out of oblivion. But at the same time, what if a person intentionally makes a mistake where they're rather cavalier or sloppy or unfocused? Then they should be held accountable. Now, the city of New York pays out huge amounts of money every year that we, the taxpayers, pay for any of those mistakes that are made in the city, by the city, or any of its employees, and the police are right up there at the top of the list. So I believe that we also have to take a look at the entire structure, break it down. For example, there's an interesting article from Global Research, and it's about the militarized police. Now, let me just share this with you, because you may not know this, Rudy. The militarization of American law enforcement has been, in a sense, institutionalized through programs set up by the federal government and the states to train with Israeli police, a mentoring relationship established by Michael Chertoff when he was Secretary of Homeland Security. And the joint training programs run in Israel are being used to indoctrinate American police forces and are difficult to comprehend as related to normal policing, as the Israelis are clueless when it comes to conducting investigations or protecting all of their country's citizens. Israel's cops are at the forefront of state violence against Palestinians, as well as serving as protectors of rampaging, heavily armed settlers who destroy Arab livelihoods so they can, in effect, confiscate their land. The Israeli police are also quite good at using what is called the Palestinian chair for torture when they're not shooting Arab teenagers in the back. They also invented skunk water, a disgusting-smelling chemical spray initially used against Arab demonstrators, and were the first major police force to regularly employ so-called rubber bullets, which, by the way, are not rubber. They can kill or maim people, and they do. In fact, there have been suggestions that certain American policemen might well be picking up some unanticipated pointers from the Israelis. Georgia has been experiencing a surge in officers-involved shootings, nearly half of the victims being unarmed or shot from behind. As this has unfolded, the state continues to pursue a police exchange program with Israel run through Georgia State University. So the police exchange programs began 27 years ago in 1992, 93, and are being paid through grants from the U.S. Department of Justice, as well as from the state and local governments, which means we, the taxpayer, are paying for all this. And so all these different states in America are sending their police over there. So when you understand how a person is trained, for example, a favorite technique used by the Israeli police to subdue an Arab is the very knee on neck used by Derek Chauvin that killed George Floyd. Minnesota has been actively involved in training its police with the Israelis to include participation in over 100 officers in just one conference in Minneapolis hosted by Israel's Chicago consultant. They learned the restraint procedures employed by Israelis, and the conference was jointly hosted by the FBI, and the facilities were provided by the city. And the meeting itself was funded by the federal government and the state. So you have to understand that hold the police accountable, but understand in that training of the police officer, they're getting a different type of training. They should completely be retrained. Every police person must go through a complete reorientation. And then I think that you're onto something when you have also in every precinct, you must have a civilian, not a civilian review board, because those have not done a whole lot of good, though they were intentional to be good for the people, but rather have groups that meet on a regular basis in every community and have the police in the community, meaning from the community, who are then working with community leaders to help prevent the crimes to begin with. For example, have a outreach program to people who want to leave gangs and give them safe places to live. That can be done. We have plenty of places that we can put a person who wants to exit a gang and reenter society as a constructive member of society, not a gangbanger. But you have to have a place for a person to transition from to. Now, we have it for prisoners. We have someone who's going to testify against someone and their life's in jeopardy for testifying, so we find them a relocated place to live and a stipend so at least they don't revert back to crime. We should have clinics for people who need mental health counseling and physical help can go within that community. The police should be there to see that the community that they are a part of, live in, whose children go to with other children to the same schools, are going to be far more committed, especially if they're regular meetings, where citizens who have issues first go to the advisory panel, discuss their concerns with the advisory panel, then the advisors from the community sit with the police officers and talk with them, and then demilitarize it. Get rid of the tanks, get rid of all the armor, get rid of all that, just the way police used to walk around in a uniform, all right? Walking the beat, and more should walk the beat. More should understand what are the needs of the community. Then, by extension, every city should look at every neighborhood and ask, is this neighborhood providing a quality of life? And then in every ghetto in America, every ghettoized neighborhood, of which there are thousands, we should have free zones, meaning we bring in small businesses or larger ones, but the small ones can apply for a no-interest three-year loan 3 years before they have to make a payment back. And these are microloans. And the microloans could go to people who want to open up their own little business, but their rent and other expenses are controlled by the free zone cooperative, not by greedy landlords. And let me tell you have no idea how bad it is to be up against the landlord who doesn't care whether you survive. They'll just say, well, I'll put a Duane Reade in or some other store if you don't want the increased rent. Even in this terrible time, landlords are asking for increases in rent with emptiness of up to, and vacancies up to 60%, and at least 40% of all closed businesses will never be able to reopen. So what if you had in every community, you had an area rehabilitated with corporate dollars that are 2-to-1 deductible, meaning if a corporation gave $1,000, they got to deduct 2 off their taxes. Right now, they're deducting, so they're not paying any taxes, but we get no benefit from that. So that way, you would be able to benefit the society, and then your rent would be pegged to a floating standard of what you're making. just like sales taxes. Sales taxes on items common to life, like food and water and gasoline, they should be very low. And luxury items should be higher. So those who can afford luxury can afford the taxes. Those who can't afford it except for the basics will not be overburdened by the tax basis, the same way with the rent. And then you also have housing set aside that are fixed-rate housing, so that it's not based upon a fixed amount, it's based upon your income. So if you're a retiree, if you're a poor person, you maybe have to pay 30% of whatever income you have in. But then again, being a part of this zone, businesses wouldn't be paying state taxes. So therefore, it'd be like living in Florida or living in Texas, the two best states in America to live in at this time as far as, you know, quality of life compared to government overreach and over-authority. So once you start looking at how you rebuild a ghetto, you rebuild people's lives, you bring businesses back, you bring industries back, you bring something the society controls itself. These are not mega corporations coming in like Walmart and setting down a store that destroys other all local stores. Every time you see a Whole Foods open, all the local health food stores within 2 miles go bankrupt because they can't compete. They can't purchase and get the discounts in the same scale of order. So economy of scale is called. So that's how you rebuild a society, by providing the citizens the quality of life they need. And the police are but one part of that. But anyhow, there's more to it. It's just give you some ideas. I would completely share a different point of view with you on your first one. I do not believe it's the responsibility of the universities to give a curriculum unsupervised to people and say, now read these books. And I would offer a different point of view that, you know, it's a cultural shock. No, the shock is living in an artificial bubble, as millions of young people do. And that's one of the things you'll see between those that come from more entitled backgrounds where their parents are rich, or let's say not just rich, but maybe professional class, and therefore the money they have available to spend, the places to travel, the opportunities they have are going to far exceed the average working class person. So the average working class person tends to be much more grounded, much more focused, much more appreciative of the opportunities they've gotten. I can tell you that as someone who's hired people, a lot of people in my life, and those who come from working class backgrounds, or at least come with good character, where that's their parents, that's the people who raised them, helped them, inspired, and then they saw the value of that at some point and continue to carry it forward as their own. Those are wonderful people to have to work with, versus the people come in whenever they want, leave whenever they want, don't do good work to begin with, and believe they should be entitled to whatever they want because, after all, they've gotten anything they wanted up this point. So if you're suggesting, and unless I misinterpreted what you said, that somehow universities should change their curriculum and the way curriculums are taught to the needs of the students, then you've just allowed all of our universities to go to hell in a handbasket. Right now, students don't want to do the same work. They don't want tests. They want to be passed. They want A's. They don't want B's, even if they don't know the material. And then they can file complaint 9 against a teacher, and suddenly that teacher's life is in turmoil. And because they believe that the university should be a place that makes them feel comfortable. No, universities are not supposed to be a place. They're supposed to be where you come for critical thinking and to learn so you can go out into a world that's not going to, you know, treat you with kid gloves. It's rough and tumble in this world and always has been. So if you don't want to be prepared for it and you think you're going to always live in the vacuous emptiness of an over-congested space of mindless people, okay, that's what you're going to get. So on that one, I would share a difference of opinion. Thanks for the input. I don't have time for any more today because now I just want to share a few thoughts. And again, call in after I share these thoughts, because I've told you for a long time that I see the biggest problem as being our complete corruption of the political system. I mean corruption at every level, from the presidency to the Republican and Democratic Party and the complete umbrage that is taken towards the legitimacy of third party candidates. We would have had a much better world had we voted for Ralph Nader and Gary Anderson and Jill Stein, but we chose not to. And that was our mistake. But for those of us who did vote for them, we knew we would lose, but at least we didn't compromise on the less of two evils. In other countries, you can have 20, 30, 100 different parties, and that's the way it should be, because then you get more ideas of what could be done and how to do it and work with coalitions. And here we have two parties with one controlling factor. Now, take a look at the world we live in today and see it through the eyes of Professor Henry Giroux. I'm sure all of you have seen this. It's not hidden. It's right in plain sight. Because in its late stages, capitalism morphs into a form of neoliberal fascism. Do you remember I said it was neoliberal fascism that was behind all of our problems? Because it is the conditioning dominant factor. In this instance, the structural misery produced by capitalism via its destruction of the welfare state and the safety net and its growing investment in accelerating inequality and criminalizing all social programs and creating problems merges with the theater of racism and racial cleansing and hypermasculinity and ultranationalism and militarism and scapegoating the vulnerable and the politics of disposability. And unfortunately, when one party's in power, it believes that the opposite power is a disposable power. It doesn't share power with it. It doesn't look for the best answers. It doesn't try to correct itself from its overreach. No. Did you hear Clinton's, either of them, because they were co-presidency, apologize about Rwanda and allowing the genocide to manifest as we know it did, or Yugoslavia? No. What about, you know, with Uganda? No. And how about Barack Obama with Fast and Furious and all the other missteps? No. And the support embracing of clean coal and nuclear power as renewable energies? No. No, nobody apologized for anything, not for Gaddafi's murder and the murder and destruction of the most important nation in the history of at least recent history of Africa. No, cruelty and hate now become a badge of honor among the financial, political, and corporate elite. One consequence is not merely a criminogenic political and economic system, but a state of barbarism that reflects the psychosis among political leaders like Trump and Bolsonaro and all of those who support hate campaigns. You know, we don't have unity. This is not merely a matter of truth or morality being abandoned in the interest of producing a fascist politics. It represents the emergence of a politics that mimics the transition from the mentality of greed and the concentration of power in a few hands, celebrated in the film Wall Street, to a dangerous state of mind in which violence and death become the organizing and governing principles of a society. Did you see the media regale about the uniqueness of the new military appliances being used in 2003 invasion of Iraq? They were more interested in the new missiles, the new guided systems, and there was always someone from the military-industrial complex, the Pentagon, or one of the other contractors explaining how we had the best technology in the world. But at the end of that technology, you're going to have a human life destroyed. That was never discussed. You never saw any of these dancing clown journalists from NBC, ABC, CBS, Fox. You never saw any of them over on the ground talking with the survivors when families were blown to pieces. No, we don't want to see the violence. We want to know that we were able to inflict it. No, instead of Wall Street, we get the insanity portrayed in American Psycho. Patrick Bateman has become the model for contemporary leadership under the rubric of casino capitalism. Trump, with Bateman as his alter ego, golfs, retweets, and is filled with sexist comments about anyone, discredited conspiracy far right-wing sycophantic media sources. So we have this from the left and the right. So I'm concerned. I'm very concerned because what this leads to, it leads to one day you waking up and you saying, we're in a free country. And I'm saying, you think? What if you're in New York City or anywhere in New York State, Albany, you know, Rochester, all the great cities in New York, Buffalo, and you're told that you must come to a clinic and you must get your coronavirus vaccines. You say, but I don't want a vaccine. And they say, but you must. And you say, well, no, it's my body, it's my right. And they're going to say, no, you are not sovereign over your body when it comes to our decisions. You have no right to be vaccinated. You have, you know, not to be vaccinated. You have no right not to wear a mask. You have no right to open up your business. And if you refuse to be vaccinated, the state has the power to literally take you to a doctor's office and plunge a needle into your arm. That is a direct quote from Alan Dershowitz, Harvard Law professor. So you have no rights? That's the lesson the government wants us to learn from the COVID-19 business calamity. Well, the government is wrong. For years now, the powers that be, those politicians and bureaucrats who think like tyrants and act like petty dictators, regardless of what party they belong to, have attempted to brainwash us into believing that we have no right to think for ourselves, make decisions about our health, protect our homes and families and businesses, act in our best interest, demand accountability and transparency from government, or generally operate as if we're in control of our own lives. We have every right. And you know why? Because we were born free. As the Declaration of Independence states, we are endowed, quote, we are endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights to life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness that no government can take away from us. Unfortunately, that hasn't stopped the government from constantly trying to usurp our freedoms at every turn. Indeed, the nature of government is such that it invariably oversteps its limits, abuses its authority, and flexes its totalitarian muscles. And here is the kicker. What they're really talking about is martial law, packaged as a well-meaning and overriding concern for the nation's security. This COVID-19 crisis is pushing us that much closer to that dystopian vision becoming a present-day reality. For starters, let's talk about the COVID-19 stormtroopers, the SWAT team raids, and ongoing flare-ups of police brutality, with millions of dollars in stimulus funds being directed towards policing agencies across the country. The federal government plans to fight this COVID-19 virus with riot gear, gas masks, ballistic helmets, drones, and high-tech surveillance technology. Indeed, although crime rates have fallen dramatically in the midst of this global COVID-19 lockdown, there's been no relief from the brutality and violence of the American police state. While the majority of the country has been social distancing under varying degrees of lockdowns, it's been business as usual for the nation's SWAT teams and police training to shoot first and ask questions later. In Kentucky, plainclothes cops and unmasked cars used a battering ram to break down Barona Taylor's door and carry out a no-knock raid on her home after midnight. Fearing a home invasion, the 26-year-old emergency medical technician and her boyfriend, who had been in bed at the time of the invasion, called 911 and prepared to defend themselves. Taylor's boyfriend shot one of the intruders, later identified as police, in the leg. Police fired 20 shots into the apartment in a neighboring home, killing Taylor. The drug dealer, who was the target of the late-night raid, lived 10 miles away and had already been arrested prior to the raid on Taylor's home.
But I hope that you got the message. And the message is that I see the problem today as an overreach of those who are given power and then, like a spreading metastasized cancer, extend it without ever giving it back. And we have no power over our own lives. Everything is micromanaged. Every phone call, every voicemail, facial recognition, drones, all these are being used 24/7 on every citizen in the United States by people that we don't know, we'll never meet, but they are building cases that now they want to have new technology, and it's here now that it's a cap. It looks like a little let's just visualize a little bowl that's on your head, but it's made out of a material, and it has like a spine that goes down your spine, and it's able to read your brain. It's able to read your mind, able to read your thoughts. So when will that be implemented so that when you're taken into custody or they decide to question you, that they can see what you're actually thinking and what you've actually thought? Could you imagine it? A computer, an artificial intelligence computer, can now read your thoughts, present and historic, and we don't protest that? So you see, we're rapidly approaching the place within our society where our society is broken down, and we are the victims of it. Tomorrow, Richard Gale and I will be having a discussion and a commentary on some comments made last evening on CNN that, oh, you know, all the rioting and, you know, including taking over six blocks of Seattle as a sovereign, you know, new entity, that's cool. It is? That's cool? Okay. And they're armed and they're going store to store and telling the people they want money if they want to keep their business open. You take over six blocks. You've got a lot of people, over 1,000 people could live in six blocks. You're taking them hostages? You're declaring yourself sovereign over everyone who's lived there and worked there? And you're guarding it with police? And that's like our Boston Tea Party. Well, we will share a difference of opinion. Protest, yes. Protest inequality, racism, yes. Protest against war, against the invasion of people's rights, yes. Engage in violence, destruction, no. So tomorrow we'll have a discussion and a commentary on that, and we look forward to calling in and sharing your points of view. Sorry for the late in the program interruption, and since we are running out of time, I didn't have a chance to play that clip about finding happiness, so we'll play that tomorrow on our program. But go up and look at the 33 posted lectures, some brand new, and I haven't posted any in 5 years. So at the anti-aging clinical study, I did a lot of lectures, over 60, and I filmed a lot of them, and I felt those that would benefit all the people in this audience are there. They're there for you to enjoy and to benefit from if you choose to. Just go to prn.fm and scroll down and you'll see them. All right? Have a nice day, everyone.